take a ride? Call Art Bell.
Perhaps the heaviest test our servers have ever faced. And they're down for the count. A few people are getting through, but it's a disaster up there. The reason is this. We sent out a signal from Arecibo in 1974. Appearing in a field near a deep space telescope appears to be the answer to that signal. Or it's an intricate fake beyond all reason and belief to imagine that man has done. But some do imagine that as opposed to the alternative. Certainly these images are going to remain there all weekend long. Technicians are on the way right now trying to get things rebooted or whatever it is they've got to do. But obviously, the website's getting slammed. So just keep trying. You will get through. There are some fascinating comparisons for you up there tonight. Coming up in a moment, author of The Isaiah Effect, Greg Braden, will get his reaction to all of this on a pretty wild night. Don't touch that dial. The Isaiah Effect. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight with Greg Braden. Let's read a little bit about that. This, three, in fact, groundbreaking experiments in the late 1990s unveiled dramatic and undeniable evidence of a newly discovered form of energy, a matrix, if you will, linking each member of our global family, creation, and the events of our lives in unexpected and empowering ways. Relegated to technical journals and receiving little attention from mainstream media, these experiments, reported by leading research institutions of our day, shake the foundation of our predominant worldview, scientifically documenting that, one, we communicate with our world, get this, folks, through a previously unrecognized form of energy that operates outside the bounds of measured time and space. Two, our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. Three, we influence our physical DNA through a non-physical form of energy that is directly linked to prayer. That's right, prayer and human emotion. Greg Braden, author of The Isaiah Effect, suggests that these and other equally empowering principles have been lost to the West through the editing and destruction of great repositories of scientific wisdom, and we'll find out more about that. Greg Braden is a very interesting fellow. He's been a featured guest for international conferences and media specials, bridging ancient wisdom and modern science, a former Earth scientist and senior aerospace computer systems designer, Phillips Petroleum, Martin Marietta Aerospace, and Cisco Systems. Braden is now considered a leading authority on the spiritual philosophy of the ancient and indigenous traditions throughout the world. Here's Greg Braden. Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Art. It's a pleasure to be here and hear your voice.
Good to have you. And I, in the last day or so, I've been speaking with you about this whole thing coming down in wheat fields in Great Britain, and of course the message that went out from Arecibo and all the rest of it. And I know you've had a chance to look, and I thought I would solicit your immediate reaction if I could.
So we'll start with all the easy questions first tonight, and then we'll work into the big stuff. Tonight is your Northern New Mexico night, I guess.
I guess.
I know Richard Hoagland was on earlier, actually. Yes. From Southern New Mexico.
Yes.
And I'm speaking to you from the mountains of northern New Mexico this evening. And, I sensed you might ask a question like that as I was listening to the introduction. And I think before we even get into this, Art, we're just going to cover so much material over these next 2 hours. I'd just like to make a statement about context, the context within which all of these mysteries are unfolding in our lives and many of the programs of previous guests. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions say that this is a very unique time in human as well as cosmic history.
Why? And why is it unique? It's 2001, and that's unique because it was made that way by a novel and a motion picture, and so I guess we all have great expectations.
Well, the texts and many ancient indigenous traditions, Mayan, Egyptian, certainly the ancient Essene traditions, the authors, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Native North and South American oral traditions. In their own ways, they all say that in at this time, at the close of the last millennium and the birth of this new century, we could expect to see unusual phenomenon. Our own science now, I come from the world of science, and what I'm finding is that our scientists are finding what they consider to be anomalous, discrete, unrelated phenomenon, unprecedented in our recorded history.
It is true.
Solar bursts, magnetic flips, magnetic declines.
So much so, Greg, that our greatest minds, you know, our greatest theoretical physicists are having to reevaluate very quickly what they think might be true.
Well, certainly, and I've had the honor to share the stage with some of those physicists at conferences in the last few months, Michio Kaku, to mention...
Yeah, they're scrambling.
Well, they are, and so the context, there is a framework in other traditions that allow for the kinds of phenomena we're seeing. Our Western tradition never really allowed for that. So to us, and to science, you know, science is relatively new. It's only 300 or 400 years old, the scientific method. So to our science, these events don't really have a frame of reference on the one hand. And when we look at other traditions, there is a frame of reference. And the bottom line is that this is a time of great change. It's an opportunity for us to know who we are, how we relate to creation, our origins, our capabilities, the capabilities, the latent capabilities that live within our bodies. And it's within that context that we're seeing the phenomenon such as the crop circles. So I wanted to say that this is kind of a foundation that we'll tie back into.
All right. By the way, our website is really experiencing just unprecedented amounts of traffic right now. And so before we call for people to look at any images, let us wait until I get word that we can do that again.
I actually tried to get on just before the show.
Yeah,
we put some images up there earlier today that I'll reference.
I know, but please don't reference them yet.
Oh, well, I couldn't see them.
Yeah, that's right.
So what I'd like to say about the crop circles, right? I've been deeply involved with many researchers from many walks of life. Crop circles, the Shroud of Turin researchers, Dead Sea Scrolls, Egyptologists, geneticists, and we're going to bring all that to bear on the mystery of tonight. Many people have asked me whether or not I believe this crop circle phenomenon is authentic or if it's a hoax. What I can say is I was in the fields in 1993 and 94 studying the crop circles.
Yes.
And they were appearing at the rate of 10 to 12 a night.
Right.
In fields where they hadn't been only 6 hours earlier, over 500 per month in England alone.
Greg, what was it like in those circles?
We were among one particular one. We were was with Colin Andrews and many of the researchers were there at a conference. There was one field. We were standing in the field at sunset, about 8:30 in the evening. There were no glyphs there, and by 5 a.m. the next morning, there was a glyph 2 football fields long. And we were some of the first there, is why I'm mentioning this, so it hadn't been trampled down yet.
Well, when you did get there, were there any signs that you saw of human activity that produced it?
Absolutely not. When you walk through those fields, I mean, even one person, a single time, you leave a path
right.
of broken stocks. There were no paths like that. And the stocks themselves, within the glyphs, are generally not broken. This is what's so interesting. They are gently bent. Between a 45 and a 90 degree angle. They are not broken. They'll still grow. They'll still produce their fruit. And they are interwoven together. They are not simply lying down. They're actually woven together in a way that is just, it's amazing to be able to see it. The seeds are from these glyphs are different. They have different properties from the seeds outside the glyphs for about 90 days. After the glyph is formed, you know, we no longer call them crop circles because they're so complex.
Yes.
For about 90 days after they're formed, when you take a seed from inside a glyph and germinate it with a seed that was not in that glyph, the seeds from within the glyph, they germinate faster, they develop quicker, they produce more berries per fruit, and then the curve levels out after about 90 days.
Yes, and there's one more thing. Dr. Levengood, as you know, has, as a means of validating these glyphs or circles, looked at molecular changes that occur that allow the kind of bending you were talking about, and it approximates being cooked. It approximates microwave of some sort.
Precisely, and this is going to be important. We'll talk about this in just a little while, and we talk about possible sources and methods. So I just wanted to say this from my experience. While I certainly acknowledge there are hoaxed crop circles out there, both in North America and England, these things are being found not only in the fields. They're being found in the deserts, in dry sand, in sage, in sand bars, in the Rio Grande River, in ice.
Even snow, yes.
In the rivers. So there's obviously a phenomenon that's happening here. I had the opportunity this afternoon to look and actually do some comparisons, and I spoke with Richard Hoagland about these earlier, at the Arecibo glyph. And there are some, and maybe you've spoken about this in the last hour, there are some obvious differences in the glyph that was returned from the one that was sent from Arecibo. And that's certainly where we're focusing. And one of those is with the description of the genetics of the being that's depicted.
Correct.
The second is the being itself, and the third is the formation of the solar system that we appear to be a part of. So I'm going to start with the last one first. The solar system depicted in the return glyph is singling out Earth, Mars, and whatever planet it is that used to be between Mars and Jupiter.
Precisely.
And those three planets in ancient traditions, there's a long history in some traditions suggesting that that's actually our original home, if we can say that without even having laid the foundation.
No, we can say that. Honestly.
And I think that says volumes right there, and then we probably will tie back into that in just a little while. The image of the body itself, and I heard Richard's program from last night. One was called the pinhead image, and one was the larger.
We would be the pinheads.
We would be the pinheads, and then there was the larger bulbous image. Many people I've spoken with today kept thinking ET, and while it's certainly easy to have that response, I've got to say, the longer I looked at this, and within the context of the rest of the glyph, what I began to see from this is it looks more embryonic than it does ET to me.
Well, then I got to looking at the DNA, and I looked at number two that you've listed in the Isaiah effect. Our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. And, of course, we depict our DNA in the message sent from Arecibo, and what's over there on the left in the message that allegedly came back, it's different, Greg.
Well, it does look different, and this is where the bulk of my adult life has been spent searching for the principles of the unity that bind our family of humankind together, and that has given me the opportunity to work with researchers in many specified fields, including geneticists. And I'll say right off, I am not a geneticist. I'm still learning. What I have come to understand, Art, is typically we talk about four DNA bases for the human genome. What we do not often hear is there's actually a fifth base that is a form. The four bases, cytosine, thymine, adenine, guanine, are very well known. There's a fifth base that occurs, we see it at birth and very early in life. And it is called a 5-MC, or 5-methylcytosine. It's actually a form of the cytosine. And this base, without going into tremendous detail, it plays a significant role in telling the cells which portions of the DNA to replicate and which portions not to replicate. And this has a tremendous implication in terms of aging and health and immune systems.
Right.
And as we begin to... the aging process that begins at birth, we begin to lose the qualities of that fifth element of DNA, and that many researchers now are believing is responsible for the aging and diseasing that we're seeing. So up to 6% of the cytosine bases at birth are of this this fifth type of DNA, and this glyph is showing an altered DNA. And if we look at this as an embryonic image, rather than as an alien or an off-planet image, it may be telling us something very important about ourselves. And this context, when we look back at the glyphs that have occurred primarily in England and all over the world since 1994, there is a recurrent theme, whether it's through the language of electronics or sacred geometry or planetary science and cosmology. All of them keep pointing back to us, telling us something about ourselves. And I think this particular glyph may just be a Rosetta Stone of glyphs. And once we understand this, I think the others are going to make tremendously more sense to us.
Well, with the intricate detail and sublime differences between what was sent and what has been received and now recognized as received, it almost seems impossible to me that human beings could have done this. I suppose it's got to be within the realm of possibility. But for me, it's much easier to believe it's either A, alien, or B, a message from time, either our own far past or our own distant future, or, I don't know, almost anything other than a couple of guys with boards and chains. I don't buy that. Do you?
Well, I don't buy that. And while I've seen from the air, I've seen glyphs hoaxed, and from the air they look pretty good. When you get up close, there's absolutely no comparison art. When you see the very fine delineation between the standing crops and where the glyph begins and the interwoven nature, there are actually in one of our first books, Awakening the Zero Point, there is actually a photograph of this interwoven nature of the crops, and I just don't know how anyone could weave those stocks together to such a degree, covering so many acres in such a brief period of time, and do so so consistently. So it'll be interesting, I think, on this glyph when the researchers actually get there to test the seeds and see if the magnetic fluctuations are there, see if the microwave fluctuations are there, and I think we'll know more about that.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. If you had to make a guess right now, a hoaxer, or aliens, or human beings, either from the future or the past, where would you be guessing?
Well, when I look at these, I'm looking at how they're made, where they come from, and what the message is, and there are three different ways to look at them. We understand, I think, the mechanism. Some of them actually, I think, originate from human consciousness. Others are coming, obviously, from somewhere else. And the message is a message that keeps playing back to us.
All right.
Well, can I hear the music so we can pick it up after
that's
the break?
Right. And we'll pick it right up at the message. I'm Art Bell, and from the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM. From Arecibo are us. In other words, we've been talking about the collective consciousness, right? What if it's a message from the collective id? From us. Actually, from inside all of us. I don't know. Just thought I'd toss that one into the mix. Hey, you know what? At about 2:30 Saturday afternoon, today or tomorrow, depending on your time zone, I'm going to do an interview with London Broadcasting Corporation, about a 10-minute interview or something, prior to the first and perhaps only running of an entire Coast to Coast AM program on LBC, London Broadcasting. If you can find your way to the website, you'd be able to hear that interview and then the broadcast itself. So for the first time, people in London are going to get exposed to this program. Now, returning to my little thought, if you read the second item in the Isaiah Effect, the Isaiah Effect is Greg Braden's new book. He says, our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. Now, if that would be true, then my little idea might have some merit. In other words, I said, what if it, in effect, is a message from the collective id produced through the energy emanating from our collective DNA? Greg?
Well, this is how the synchronicity works, right? You're about two station breaks ahead of me.
Yeah, well, sorry about that. Well, it just came to me.
Without even having defined some of the terms I know we'll get into in just a little while, from the perspective of new physics, of quantum physics, the concept of what we call the quantum hologram, the whole concept of them and us starts to get a little fuzzy, and it becomes more we. Because it says, although we may be physically in one location and our off-planet family may be somewhere else, that we are all communicating through a matrix or a web of energy. The ancient Hopi called it the web of Spider Grandmother.
And remote viewers have another name for it.
What do the remote viewers call it?
The collective consciousness.
Precisely. And, you know, the whole concept of remote viewing, I know we'll get into this as well. I know that the text, so many of the texts, such as the Isaiah text, speak of prophecy. And when we use the word prophecy in 20th century science, people's eyes glaze over and you know, they look at the raw eyes, look up at the ceiling. They just they don't want to hear that word. But we know that 20th century science takes prophecy very seriously. However, today we do call it remote viewing. And from that perspective, all of this has a tremendous relevance on everything that we're discussing here.
It all does seem to kind of come together. Well, at the bottom of the hour, we were briefly touching on the message now. What would you imagine the message from this glyph to be?
Well, the right before the station break, when I look at the crop circles, what I mentioned was that I'm looking at three aspects, the mechanism to produce them, where they came from, the source, and then what that message is. This particular glyph, the Arecibo glyph, falls into the category of some of the others. It tells me they are pointing back to us. They are telling us, the glyph is giving us information about ourselves. And because the DNA is what is changed in the return glyph, and because we know now about this fifth base of DNA that we rarely hear about in college texts and college courses, I certainly wasn't taught about when I was in school. What it's saying is that there is a quality of DNA in our bodies that prevents much of the suffering that we're seeing in our world today. And the experiments that we're going to go through this evening tell us that DNA is directly linked to human emotion by creating very specific qualities of emotion in our bodies.
Perhaps it is, in effect, modulated, I said, by human emotion.
Well, that's what we're precisely what we're finding, directly modulated by human emotion. And this is when we go back into the most sacred texts and the most ancient traditions of our kind, our people who have come before us, they were trying to say something to us. They left massive temples and volumes, entire libraries, in a language of their time, saying that there is a message regarding the wisdom of creation and how we relate to creation. They were attempting to convey that to us, and I think that's what we're finding, whether we're looking at the Isaiah scroll or the Egyptian temple walls or the crop circles in England. Right?
I wonder if they might be talking to us, in effect, messaging us about this, because we are, of course, on the precipice of cloning. As you know, it's
yes.
Underway as we speak, and beginning to tamper with human DNA.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that has something to do with the timing, because what we found there is a history of crop circles or crop glyphs appearing in response to human consciousness. For example, in 1991, just outside of the university in Cambridge, England, where Noit Mandelbrot developed the equations for what we call the Mandelbrot set and the fractal graphics. And the wheat field just outside of his window was the one time that that a glyph occurred, and it was undoubtedly the Mandelbrot set glyph.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers had been in the office the night before saying, you know, this crop circle phenomenon, it's interesting, but we can't get our hands around it. If just once we could get a glyph that we could validate mathematically, then we'd have something to talk about. The next morning, the Mandelbrot set is outside the window. Well, I was with Colin Andrews in 1994 in Salisbury at the crop circle conference. We were looking at glyphs from a very ancient Egyptian temple in the Abydos Seti complex. I know you've been there before.
Yes.
Called the Flower of Life.
That's right.
We were focusing on that glyph, and people asked at the last hour of the conference, wouldn't it be interesting if this appeared somewhere near the conference facility, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, without a shadow of a doubt, the Flower of Life. I mean, it was unmistakable.
Greg, everybody asks, and maybe you have an answer you'd like to, or you'd like to toss something toward this. Everybody asks, why England?
Why England? Well, the truth is that the crop circles have now been registered on every nation, on every continent.
Absolutely true,
but the
most complex of them certainly have been in Great Britain.
Precisely. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know why they are focused there, but they are obviously showing up in many different forms and from different media throughout the world. I don't know why so many are showing up in England per se, and what I know is that there are many that show up and are actually mowed under before the public ever has the opportunity to see them.
Very much aware of that. The ones that have showed up elsewhere, particularly in North America, have been like the ones that first showed up in Great Britain. They began very simply and increasingly became more complex,
yes,
as if to teach.
Well, precisely, and again, they seem to fall into categories, Art. It's very interesting. Some of them are biological, some are mathematical, some are based on ancient sacred geometric principles, and some are regarding cosmology. Very interesting one, 1993, showed our solar system, a very perfect replica of our solar system, and every planet was in its orbit except for one conspicuous difference, and that was that there was no Earth in the orbit. There was an orbit, and there was no Earth there. Many people interpreted that to say that the Earth was going to disappear, and others interpreted it to say the Earth as we know it will no longer exist. There's a new Earth emerging, and that certainly falls in line with the ancient texts and the prophecies and the traditions. So I think that with out of context, these are strange and mysterious phenomenon that they really don't have a lot of meaning within the context of this time in history, the great change that's been predicted, that science is now seeing, and that the ancient and indigenous peoples allow for in their traditions, it becomes one more phenomenon that asks us to look back at ourselves and our relationship to our world and creation.
Maybe we weren't getting it, Greg. In all the years of these complex, impossibly complex crop circles in Great Britain, I looked at them as a layperson, and I went, oh, my God, like everybody else, that's beautiful. Man could not have done that. I don't believe man did that. But I couldn't get past, that's beautiful, it's symmetrical, it seems like there's something mathematical about it.
Sure.
But maybe we weren't getting it. So what do we have now? We have a face. No question about it. I look at that, Greg, and I see a face.
Oh, there's definitely a face there.
And then we have this intricate glyph that seems to be answering our Arecibo message. That I can sink my teeth into.
Well, it's our language. It's our language that we sent to communicate with the cosmos. And what better language to acknowledge that the message was received. And by the way, here are a few little things you might want to look at in your message when it's returned to us.
Well,
now I didn't hear what Richard said in the research that happened through the day today. Did they find any more about the genetics or the actual human form that was shown on?
They're still working on the genetic part of it, to be sure. That's a pretty deep field in itself, so that's going to take a little time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that it's going to make sense when we get a familiar with the science of genetics to comment. There's going to be something there, I'm almost willing to bet.
Well, one of the great mysteries in the life sciences, and it has been since 1953-54 when Watson and Crick formulated the genetic code, is why so much of human DNA appears to be unused. Of the 64 codes, approximately two-thirds of them appear to be switched off or dormant.
Right.
We only use about a third of our genetic code. And when I was in school, I was taught that code is fixed. And what we now know, Art, is although we only have those 64 possibilities, that within our lifetime, through choices that we make in our lives, we can actually turn those codes off and on the fly through choices that we make with an internal technology that I believe the ancients referred to in the language of their time. Today we call it thought, feeling, and emotion. And when we turn those codes off and on, what we find, 1998, for example, the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center did a global blood study and found that individuals who had tested positive for the AIDS virus had actually turned on sets of genes. And they identified, University of Alabama, Birmingham, identified five sets of genes that gave these individuals up to 3,000 times greater immune response than we've ever seen before. And what that says is that we, the human race, will not succumb to the HIV virus as predicted back in the early 1980s. We are actually developing a genetic mutation in the same generation where the virus has occurred. It's not in future generations. And when I was in school, I was taught that this kind of thing simply cannot happen.
Is that evolution at much better than macro level?
Well, I believe it is. And if we take it one step further, according to the ancient texts, such as we'll get into with the Isaiah text, it can be done intentionally through choices that we make in our lives to think, feel, and emote in specific ways. We actually have the chemical result of that being registered in our bodies. It says that we have an tremendously enhanced immune system, that our cells heal faster, up to 100 times faster than what we've seen without these kinds of enhancements. And those codes are enabled where they have been disabled in the same individuals earlier in their lifetime. This is an amazing thing to be able to even speak about here this evening. And it points to, Art, the beginning of a very sophisticated internal technology that I believe is referenced many, many different ways in the language of their time, texts that we're seeing 2,000 and 3,000 and 5,000 years ago. Now we're just beginning to make sense of those texts because quantum science has discovered a language.
Well, I understand, and perhaps the audience could best understand if I explain very briefly that there is a signal. Now, if I turn Greg's pot down, and I say absolutely nothing for a few seconds, all you will hear is an unmodulated signal. There. That was an unmodulated signal. In other words, you hear nothing. Or if you're listening to AM radio, perhaps you hear a carrier, the carrier of the radio station, that would like to be carrying my modulation because they hate dead air. When I speak, or when Greg speaks, we have modulation. In other words, we have information imparted to this carrier. Is it not possible that our DNA, with this energy we are just discovering, is in effect modulating the energy that we are now just discovering, and that it is having the effect that laid down these patterns in the field, something that I think has to be at least considered?
Well, precisely. Wait until we get into these experiments tonight, Art. They, in very lay terms, we're going to be describing phenomenon that many people think are mysterious miracles, and they're being documented now in laboratory situations. What it says, the bottom line to all of this, and the ancient many of the ancient texts, the scrolls, the biblical edits that we lost, they're saying that we're directly related to the physical matter of the world around us, and that through emotions in our bodies, we can change the DNA in our bodies, and that DNA is what affects the world around us. It says there's a direct link, and that we are no longer observers, that we are participants in the events that unfold in our lives. And to many people, that's a frightening prospect. And to many others, it's a great relief.
I guess if it were universally realized, we could begin making some, you know, rather positive changes. But if you look at the general situation in the world right now, Greg, and you suggest to yourself that we are doing it,
mm-hmm.
Then we would appear to some to be somewhat suicidal.
Well, I certainly don't suggest we're doing it consciously. What I believe is because we have lost the memory of the capabilities that live within each of us, within every man, woman, and child that's ever walked this earth, there is an internal technology. Religions were built around it, although it's not a religious process. Because we've lost that awareness that the technologies are running rampant, or the chaos is a result of those unrealized potentials. Well, before the evening's over, I'll share with you case histories and global studies that have been done when many people amass in communities and on the global level, coordinated through the World Wide Web,
yes,
and the effects that we're seeing. I know you've done some of this work on your program as well.
I've done it to the point where it scared the hell out of me, and I stopped.
Well, while researchers, because a field of energy is being affected that we are still learning to measure, this nebulous matrix, or what some are calling the quantum or non-local hologram,
mm-hmm.
because we're still learning to measure that, we cannot say scientifically that there is a direct cause and effect. What we can do is say that during what the researchers call the prayer window, or the period of time when many people come together. We're getting ahead of ourselves here, but this
and
is
I don't know, Greg. I've seen it rather direct. The experiments I ran, I don't know if you were a listener to the program back when we were doing that.
With the weather patterns.
Oh, my Lord, Greg. We changed the weather in impossible ways. We did a few really impossible things, and, you know, with millions of people participating, I'm aching to try it again, but I'm afraid to try it again.
Well, what has happened, a number of studies were done in the late 70s, early 80s. The Isaiah scroll, and again, we're going to get into this as we go through the evening, the bottom line to the Isaiah scroll, to the one portion that we retranslated and wrote about, Isaiah says to us in the language of his time that there are many possibilities unfolding in every moment of our lives, and that through the feelings in our bodies, we determine which of those plays out in our world. In our local world as well as our global world. And he gives us the instructions. He says, this is how you do it. So through the World Wide Web, listening stations were set up to measure the effects. And during very specific times that researchers call the window, when people are joined together in this feeling-based technology, what we can say is there's a high correlation.
You found measurable effects.
Measurable effects. Peace treaties were signed. U.S. warplanes turned around.
I'm sure not surprised.
Midair.
When we get back, maybe we can discuss why we are now backing away from peace treaties and putting people who want to put space-based weapons in charge. Listen, stay right there. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. Take a ride? Well, call Art Bell. Well, it makes sense to me. Energy modulated by our DNA. In other words, the information comes from the DNA. The result in crop fields in England and around the world and a lot of other things, weather changes, things that we've all been able to collectively do. You know, if you're religious, you might want to call it soul power. You can call it anything you want, but that may be how it happens. This energy that we all don't understand, maybe it's really soul energy. All right, our website is back. I repeat, our website is back. The technicians have reached it, rebooted the servers, and everything appears to be running again. Therefore, if you would like to see Hoagland's analysis of recent crop glyphs, an apparent or possible or alleged answer, if you will, to a broadcast sent out in 1974 by Arecibo, it's up there to be seen. Under What's New, you can look at Hoagland's analysis of recent crop glyphs. Look at where it's located. It'll blow your mind. In addition, you go to program and tonight's guest info, and you look at the newest up there, both by Richard Hoagland. And then if you'll just scroll down a little bit under the name Greg Braden, you'll see photos for tonight's discussion. And you're going to want to click on that, too, because that's where we're going. When we, at the top of the hour, when we stopped, we were talking about documented results of using this energy that may be modulated, in effect, by our DNA into the collective consciousness. And you were saying there are documented results. Can you get specific, Greg?
Well, there certainly are, and we break these down into categories. There are documented results for personal effects, where we can actually, through the magic of ultrasound, see physiological changes inside of a human body within 3 to 4 minutes in the presence of very specific kinds, qualities of human emotion. That's for individuals. And then on the global level, on the mass level,
mm-hmm.
when many people come together in moments of shared emotion, very specific qualities of emotion, and we're going to find those in just a moment, what we can see is that in large population centers, traffic accidents decline, emergency room visits in hospitals decline, violent crimes against people decline, the stock market soars. During what researchers call the window, when these effects are being created and when the window closes, when the effects stop, when people stop doing these things, those numbers reverse. 1998, we had the opportunity through the World Wide Web to set up a special program, an experimental program. It was actually called The Great Experiment, and we did three versions of it between 1998 and the year 2001. And what happened was, in 98, 84 nations, several hundred thousand people participated in a collective time of peace. And the secret, the key to this internal technology, to this lost mode of prayer that's described in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of our most ancient texts, is that this inner technology, it has no outer expression. There are no words to this modality of prayer. It simply is a feeling, and it's feeling the feeling as if the prayer has already been answered, rather than asking for intervention and asking that the answer to the prayer come to pass.
Well, you know, a lot of people in the modern world, Greg, would say, oh, come on, this is really touchy-feely stuff. And,
well, sure.
And you know, they would say that because in the modern world, we're really not all that touchy-feely at all. We're very materialistic. And so these things have been absent to a large degree, except among very small groups, for such a long time that, of course, people would think that.
Well, precisely, Art. Maybe what, you know, the best thing to do, the first hour, we covered a lot of ground. Maybe what I'd like to do is just go back, build a little foundation of where all this comes from, so that we can tie back into this for the next 3 or 4 hours, however long that we're going.
Sure.
Because many of my colleagues in the industry, I come from the world of science, aerospace and earth and space and ocean sciences, and they say, well, how come we've never heard of any of this? If this form of energy exists, and if we have access to our world through this form of energy, why don't we know about it? That's a very good question. And what we know, this could be a whole program unto itself, obviously, is that tremendous amounts of information have been lost to the West since the year 48 B.C. In the year 48 B.C., we know that what was known as the Great Library of Alexandria burned to the ground during the Civil War, and Roman historians, before it was destroyed, cataloged, Art, over 532,000 scrolls. Many of the scrolls had multiple authors and held what the ancient Hebraic, Babylonian, Sumerian, Egyptian, and Greek scholars considered to be the great secrets of creation. Almost universally, ancient texts say there was a time in the history of our world when this is their words, these aren't my words, they say when the wisdom of the heavens was given to the people of our world, and the scholars say this is what was contained in these texts. So we lost a lot during the great library of Alexandria, the loss of that library, and during the biblical edits of the 4th century, we know at least 45 books were either completely deleted or condensed, rearranged, and edited to become what we now know as our Western biblical text.
Now, one might ask, though, Greg, if the ancients had this knowledge,
mm-hmm.
which translates to power, yeah. power to change, right?
Certainly.
Change things in the world, if not the universe as we know it, then how come they're gone and their text is dust and we're here?
Well, what apparently began to happen was when the information was given to the people of this world, it was given in the language of another time. And over time, that language began to make less and less sense to all but a small group of people, apparently. They became what we know as elite priesthoods and mystery schools. And in the language of their time, they did their best to preserve this kind of wisdom. We know about it because we're rediscovering many of those texts in the vaults of the Vatican Library, for example, in the private libraries of the Habsburgs, and in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that, again, I mean, that could be a whole program unto itself. But that brings us fast forward to the Dead Sea Scrolls. First discovered, the first scrolls were found in 1946. They were announced in 1947. Between 46 and 56, over 225,000 fragments of papyrus and copper and animal hide were pieced together, and they became eventually about 850 scrolls. Of those, only one was found completely intact. And that one scroll is believed to be so precious by scholars today, it's not even about dollars. It's so precious that it is displayed, it's 22 feet long, and it's unrolled on a cylinder that is designed to retract into a concrete and steel-reinforced vault under the floor with steel doors to cover and protect it in the event of a natural disaster or a nuclear attack on Israel. And we must ask, what could possibly warrant that kind of protection for this scroll?
Scroll,
it's the Great Isaiah Scroll.
I'm asking.
Well, what we're saying, everything we're about to do this evening is contained, references are contained in that Great Isaiah Scroll. What Isaiah is saying to us in the language of his time that was given to him from a previous time is that within every moment of our lives, there are many worlds that exist. We touch those worlds through the language of emotion in our bodies. When we feel the feeling in our bodies, the feeling is what awakens that possibility, that quantum possibility, and brings it to bear upon our lives. And now quantum science is saying precisely the same thing through the language of Dr. Hugh Everett III from Princeton University, who formulated in 1957 the parallel worlds possibilities. And Michio Kaku is talking about the 10 and 11 dimensions.
That's right.
Of the superstring theory. Emotion, human emotion, is the language that speaks to the forces of creation and awakens those possibilities, and that's what was edited and lost in the biblical text. In the 4th century, when we lost that, and you're precisely correct, Art, we became a very logic-based, non-touchy-feely, male-dominated, schematically-oriented society, and it has served us very well. It's brought us to the point where now we must come to terms with the rest of the picture to survive.
Yeah, we're mostly hardware guys.
Well, and what some of the greatest minds of our time are saying, and what the ancients said, is that it is that very technology that will turn around and bite us, that our technology will bring us to a point and it will fail us. And when it fails us, if we have not recognized the internal technology, the honoring of the life and our relationship to the world around us, that may be the end of this cycle.
And us.
Pardon me?
And us.
And us. And that is only one possibility that is referenced. And at the same time, many of the greatest prophets, Nostradamus, Edgar Cayce, Isaiah, the first Old Testament prophet, he also said he foresaw another time when that never happened. He said, I see a time when the disease is gone, when war isn't even written in the books any longer, when the deaf hear and the blind see, and the weather of the earth is gentle and crops grow in their season.
Mm.
And he said, both of them are possible. Here's how you determine which of those become your reality. Now the language of quantum physics has become the bridge that allows us to make sense of what he said, and that's the foundation of everything we're doing tonight. I'd like to...
All right, well, while technology is on our side and the website is up, you have put up images tonight.
All right.
And I'm looking at one of them, and if I had not gone up and looked at the word fetus, for example, above the first photograph that you've got here, everybody can get to that by going to my website, artbell.com.
Okay, well, we're going to have to set this image up a little bit.
Okay, we shall give people time to get there. Program, tonight's guest info, under the name Greg Braden, you'll see the images for tonight. Click on that and join us. I would not have known that was a fetus, so go ahead and set it up. What?
Well, okay, we haven't talked about the three experiments yet, so... Now that you've brought this up, we'll go through this, and we're going to go back and talk about the three experiments and tie these in.
Good. Let's do it.
Quantum physics is saying now, and many ancient traditions say, there's a field of energy that, a web, if you will, or a matrix that links every particle of creation in ways that we're only beginning to understand. One of the early, very well-known researchers that took this one step further, rather than theorizing, they actually began working with this, was a gentleman, a British engineer during World War II. His name was George Delawarr. And you may be familiar, maybe some of your guests have referenced him on the show before. His job, he had a great job description, Art, in World War II. His job was to find the energy matrix that is responsible for the human mind, because the thinking was that... that military secrets were leaking through this energy matrix, and his job was to work with that. So to make a long story very brief, he created a machine that, once given the sample of any physical, any living system in the world, if he had a little piece of it, by virtue of the holographic principle, he could reproduce the entire image no matter where he was in the world. One of the first experiments he did, he produced over 400 photographs in a hospital in the late 40s, early 50s. The image that you're seeing, and I don't have this in front of me on the machine, so I'm just going, I'm assuming it's the first image up there.
That's right.
He was in England, in the hospital in England. A woman in the States was pregnant. She didn't know how far along she was. She sent a droplet of her blood, and that's all that was sent. To him in England, he used his machine to tune to the field of energy that surrounds every living system and photographed what he found in that field. He could have tuned to her body. However, he knew that she was pregnant, so he tuned to the fetus and where he would have the clearest image of the fetus.
From a drop of blood?
From a single drop of blood. So what you're seeing is not an X-ray.
Oh, my.
It is a photograph of an energetic imprint in London from a woman in the States that is derived from a droplet of blood.
Oh, my God. Tell me about this machine a little bit. What was this machine?
Well, it's all based on very fundamental principles that we know as radionics, psychotronics, that are tuning into what we call the quantum hologram. Now, one of the things, when we show this on the big screen... In our workshops, one of the things that is conspicuously absent in this image, and it's upside down the way it was scanned, and I apologize.
Oh,
for that.
Okay. Suddenly got it upside down.
Mind,
it's
if you can
fetus.
Reverse it, one of the things that's conspicuously missing, Art, is the umbilical cord.
Yes.
That you would expect to see on a fetus. However, if you will look at the back of the crown on the top of the head, what you see is, and that's as far as the machine would take it, you see the equivalent of an umbilical cord coming from the top of the head.
I see it.
This is not a physical image. This is an energetic image. And throughout the ancient texts, we're told again and again that our energetic umbilical cord is through the crown chakra of the body. And this may be one of the first images that we have that actually shows the umbilical, the crown umbilical, coming from just to the back. You find the top center of the head.
Oh, no, I see it. I see it clearly. Once you understand the image is upside down,
there's
problem.
Something else very interesting in that image, and again, I don't have it in front of me, but if you look, it appears to have scratches.
Yes.
Different portions of it.
Yes.
I'm working with a researcher, a shroud researcher. Her name is Sue Benford, and some of her work is credited and linked on our websites as well. I was speaking with her about those marks, and the physicists that she's worked with have had the opportunity to see these, said they are definitely not scratches, and they suspect that they may actually be particles, what they were calling tachyon particles, that were moving through that energetic field when the image was created. Now, again, this is not a photograph. It's not an X-ray.
No, this was derived from one drop of blood supplied by a pregnant woman in America, and the picture of the fetus was then taken from that with this machine in Great Britain.
Because, in the holographic principle, when you have a portion of the whole physically, the energetic blueprint of the whole exists in its entirety. So if you've got a piece of it, you've got the whole thing through the holographic principle. Now, where this gets really interesting is if this were a fake, if it were painted, if it were simply an X-ray, even in an X-ray art, information is truncated. When we X-ray bones, they appear flattened or distorted sometimes.
That's right.
Okay. NASA has a device called a Victor VP8 analyzer. And this is the machine that takes the two-dimensional images from the satellites, the Viking images of Mars, or the satellites, the Magellan that went to Venus. It renders them in three dimensions and makes them look very alive,
mm-hmm.
because they are. And if they were simply painted images, it would not happen. Well, the next image that you're going to see when you scroll down, they took George Delawar's two-dimensional image, Sue Benford did this, ran it through the NASA VP8 analyzer, and that is the way that the VP8 analyzer renders that fetus. And what you can see is it is very three-dimensional. The information is not truncated. It is not hoaxed. It's not painted. It's not an X-ray. There is so much information contained. Even the traces of the subatomic particles that look like scratches are rendered in that three dimensions.
They sure are. Oh, my. Hold
on. There's more.
I'm sure there is. Hold it right there. Try and imagine that. One drop of a woman's blood, a pregnant woman, analyzed in Europe, produces a picture of the fetus the woman is carrying. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We're calling this the Isaiah Effect. That just arrived. It says, "Hi, Art and Greg. There is no question that group consciousness with prayer, or what I call willful intent, not only saved my life, but also allowed me to enter a parallel universe. I'm very grateful and hope you both continue this type of research." By the way, I think the work of the German scientist Max Planck proved that we have come nowhere near understanding the quantum nature of ourselves and the universe in the 101 years since he put forth his theory of quantum physics. I thoroughly support the work that Greg is doing and have a first-hand understanding that it is true. Signed, with purpose, Danyon Brinkley. Oh, God, that sound. All right, once again, here's Greg Braden. Greg, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, Art. Before we go any further, I'd just like to take a moment and acknowledge Danyon's facts and thank him for listening tonight. I know how busy he is, and it means a lot that he took a moment to send that fax to us.
Well, he was the recipient of one of the experiments when I was still doing them.
That's right. I remember that very well. Well, the information that we shared just before the break is just one little piece of a research project. And the listeners, if they're interested in seeing that entire project, it's published in the Journal of Theoretics, and we do have a hot link to that entire article on our website. So when we give out the website, they can look for that hot link, and the researcher is M. and Mary Sue Benford, B-E-N-F-O-R-D.
I think we've got a link to your website up there also.
Okay. So what we did just before the break, it, as amazing as it sounds, it falls well within the bounds of what we would expect to find, the kinds of effects we would see if there is this all-pervading field of energy, this holographic field, or the quantum hologram, as many researchers are now calling it, that links us in ways and in realms in a non-physical level that we're only beginning to understand.
I.e., everything is a collective.
Well, it is, and now I'm a little disadvantaged, Art, because I do not have the images in front of me, and I'm assuming they were placed on the website in the order that I sent them to the webmaster.
All right. The third picture down, I can only tell you as I look at it, by Sue Benford, resembles a sort of a mountain with trees.
Mountain with trees. There should be an image there that is the stomach of a cow, bovine stomach.
A bovine stomach. Okay, let me see. Yes, okay, I've got it. Bovine stomach.
Okay.
Got it. Yes.
Well, this is from the same period of time from George Delawarr. He was working with his machine at the hospital in London. A veterinarian in the States had a cow that was it was ill. He couldn't tell what was wrong with it. He'd heard about Delawarr's work, and he said, let's try it. So he sent a drop of the blood from the cow to George Delawarr. And again, Delawarr could tune to various fields from that drop of blood. He had a way of tuning. It's through resonance, and he could tune to specific organs or general views. And he focused on the stomach of the cow. And the image that you see, it is not an X-ray. It is a photograph of the energetic blueprint of the stomach of that particular cow. Like the previous image was not an X-ray. It was the energetic blueprint of the fetus and living fetus inside the woman.
Yes.
So what you're seeing there, obviously something is happening there. When you go down the next image, what is the next image showing?
This was the fourth image, by the way, not the third.
Okay,
the next image, a rendering again of a bovine stomach.
Okay, through the VP8 analyzer?
Yes, VP8.
Okay, so this is the same thing then. Researchers, Sue Benford and the researchers, took Delawarr's two-dimensional image, put it through the NASA's VP8 analyzer. This is the three-dimensional rendering.
Ah.
And you can tell, I mean, obviously there's a tremendous amount of information. It's not truncated the way you would see, expect to see an X-ray or something like that. And you can almost make out the outline of objects in the stomach. And once we see those objects, you can tell very clearly what they are.
Uh-huh.
Should be the next image down. They operated based on this information. Delawarr sent it back to the veterinarian.
Oh, my goodness.
They operated on the cow.
On the cow, and took them out.
They took them out, and the cow lived. It was it actually saved the life of the cow. And for listeners that do not have this on their screen, what the image, what you're seeing, is a piece of wire and a stone, and the wire is what makes the two humps that we're seeing. The wire is bent is two humps, like an elongated letter M.
I've got it. So the stupid cow ate some wire and a rock.
Well, that's what
happened. It boils down to, right?
That's what happened.
But that was picked up using nothing more than one drop of blood from the cow. That's just so impossible.
Well, this ties into some of the experiments we're going to talk about in a little while. What we found, what the experiments are showing, is that even when tissue is separated from a living donor by as much as 50 miles, that the tissue and the donor are still energetically linked, and we'll talk about
wow.
those in just a minute.
All right.
So these are the Delaware images, and the entire report is up there in the Journal of Theoretics. Now, we did this, Art, within just an hour or so of the program tonight. So it was done very quickly, and I apologize for, if they didn't come out as well as they'd like them or the fetus was inverted. But
no, that's quite all right.
I thought it was important. I really wanted the viewers to be able to see some of these images because what it is, it's saying that we've known, at least since the late 1800s when the principles were developed, in the 1940s when the machines were built, that there is this web or this all-pervading field of energy that links us in ways, now that we're only beginning to understand, the machines are showing that. The ancient traditions say we don't need the machines, that there's something we can do in our lives that utilizes this field of energy and produces effects in our bodies and in the world around our bodies.
No, this is just good proof for the hardware kind of people that we are right now, that's all.
Well, sure, sure. That's precisely what these images are showing. Now, before we go to the other images on the website, I'd like to share three experiments, or at least begin them before the top of the hour, and then maybe...
No, go right ahead.
We'll go through them on the other side of the hour. These and there are certainly other experiments that have been done, but these are three very, very, very poignantly describe this field of energy. The first one was done by a Russian physicist in 1991. His name is Vladimir Popanin, and on the website, I've put both his unpublished lab notes as well as the link to the replicated experiments, so people can see what he did. And essentially, what he did was he took a glass tube, took all the air out of it, and created what we call a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Although we know even in a vacuum, there's still something there.
Sure.
Light particles are called photons.
Right.
And they said even in a vacuum, photons are still there. Let's measure them and see what their distribution is. So they want to see if they were scattered or if they were random or aligned or whatever. And just as they expected, in the vacuum, the photons were completely random. That's precisely what they expected. Then, and I really, really honor their vision for doing, for even thinking about this kind of an experiment, they placed some human DNA into the vacuum.
Really?
And they said, now what effect does human DNA have on the physical molecule of DNA on the non-physical particles of light, on the photons?
Right.
They measured them again, and to their amazement, the photons were no longer random. They lined up and were aligned
By the DNA?
Following the pattern of DNA. The physical DNA had an effect.
Holy smokes.
On the light. Our world is made of light. And this was the beginning of this experiment. Now, where it gets really interesting, they took the DNA out of the vacuum and they said, let's see what the pattern of light looks like now. And to their amazement, the photons were still aligned as if the DNA were there, although it was no longer physically in the tube.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're saying, why? What could possibly...
Or how?
...be in place? How are these photons of light still connected to this physical DNA? This experiment was called the DNA phantom effect, is what it's called. It's been replicated several times. And what they're showing from this is that there is a field of energy that we haven't recognized in the past, previously unrecognized form of energy, and that the physical molecule of DNA is affecting non-physical matter, light, through this...
Maybe a good parallel would be a permanent magnet. If you get a nail near a permanent magnet and stroke it a few times,
right,
take the permanent magnet away and the nail remains magnetized.
Through a force, and we're saying why? Because the magnet's no longer there.
That's right. Well, I was just trying to come up with a parallel.
Well, that would be an analogy. There is obviously something going on in the nail that we understand. With the DNA, now for them to even think to even suspect that physical DNA would have an effect on the non-physical matter.
Well, it documents the force that we're trying to talk about here.
Well, this is the first experiment. The second one, Art, I think you're going to find really interesting. It was conducted by the U.S. Army in 1993. It was Intelligence and Security Command, 1993. And what they did was they took human DNA from a donor. They actually scraped tissue from the inside of the mouth of the donor.
Yes.
Of the donor's leukocytes, white blood cells is what they had. And this is a very interesting experiment. In the same building, so this is happening in the same building, they placed the donor in one room of the building and the donor's DNA in a very sensitive machine in another room of the same building.
Yes.
And what they did was they exposed the donor to very powerful emotional stimulus caused from video clips. So they were very graphic wartime clips, erotic clips,
gotcha.
Humorous clips, inducing very powerful states of emotion in the donor in one room, and they said, let's see if his DNA is affected in any way in another room.
Let me guess, DNA started to jump around.
Well, what they found was that the DNA, electrically, when the donor had a peak or a valley experience, the DNA in another room was experiencing the same thing. What makes this interesting is when we think about energy, typically we think about energy being generated in one place and broadcast or transmitted somewhere else. And that takes time.
Right.
There was no lag time between the time the donor had his experience and the DNA had its response. So then they separated. They began separating the donor and the DNA. They said, how far can we separate them and have this effect still in place? And they stopped the experiment when the donor and his DNA were 50 miles apart, and there was no lag time.
I don't think, had they gone to Australia, there would have been any difference.
Well,
if it's operating in the same non-local area as remote viewing,
well, precisely.
There's no difference.
Well, precisely. And obviously, this is just another way of researchers recognizing that this form of energy exists. What was interesting is the effect is not between the donor and his DNA. It is not bound by physical distance or time. And what they're actually saying is that human emotion is generating an effect working in a field that transcends time and distance. Human emotion is doing this with the physical DNA. But think of the implications of organ transplants.
Well, of course, we've already seen indications in organ transplants that information, impossible information, is imparted to the recipients of the organs of the donor.
Well, it is. And what does it mean for clones? And this is what's pushing the researchers. I think these kinds of questions are pushing the researchers scientifically. Now, we must determine and find a way to define what we call consciousness, what we call mind, what we call the soul, and what we call collective intelligence and the collective consciousness. And the questions come up, you know, if we create a human clone, does it have a soul? And how does that soul relate to the soul of the original being or the original cell? So these are all, this is just the second experiment. The third experiment, let's do all three of them, then we'll find together. The third one, the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, I've worked with very closely since 91. And they are, for listeners that may not be familiar, they are pioneers in innovative heart-based technologies. And that's probably the best way for me to describe what they're doing. One of the discoveries they made back in the early 90s was that every human heart is surrounded by a donut-shaped electromagnetic field between 5 and 8 feet in diameter. And that's only as far as the machines could measure. They think it probably extends miles on the quantum level, but the machines could only measure 5 to 8 feet.
Wow.
So this is an electrum. It's not the aura or the prana. This is a measurable electromagnetic field in the shape of a tube torus or a donut. And they know this. This is acknowledged. It's been published in JAMA, a Journal of American Medical Association, New Scientist. This is acknowledged. The question was, within that field, is there an additional form of energy that we haven't recognized generated by the human heart? Is there a non Hertzian field, a field that works beyond the bounds of our Hertz-based technology. What they did, this is, again, probably no surprise, they took some human DNA from placentas, because placental DNA is a very pristine form of DNA,
mm-hmm.
and this ties back into the crop glyph that we've just seen. Before the DNA goes through the experience of life, it is a very pristine form. And what they did was they had researchers trained in what is called emotional self-management. They could, on demand, create rage or compassion, joy or anger, through techniques that are very widely used and taught throughout their industry now. And they had them place this placental DNA in glass vials in the hands of these individuals,
mm-hmm.
and they asked them to have very specific forms of emotion. And to make a long story very brief, Art, what they found was that human emotion repeatedly, predictably, and consistently actually changed the shape, the physical shape, the winding of the way the two strands of the DNA were put together.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was that in the English language, I'm going to use words like gratitude, compassion, love, understanding, appreciation. In other cultures, it doesn't work the same. But in English, those are the words that most closely approximate the kind of emotion that we're talking about here. Those emotions relaxed the DNA to the point that the two strands were actually physically separate from one another. They were no longer intertwined. Rage, jealousy, anger, frustration wound up that DNA so tight, it was like a little knot.
Huh.
And this is important because we just touched on this earlier. The codes that are turned off and turned on in our genetic code appear to be linked to the way the DNA is twisted in our cell. So certain forms of emotion appear to turn on the codes of immune, tremendously enhanced immune systems and healing abilities through love, compassion, understanding,
mm-hmm.
forgiveness. Others actually deplete those qualities, actually turn those codes or inhibit those codes by having the DNA so knotted up. Now, and there are other experiments, but these three, what they're saying is
very compelling. Oh, very compelling.
What they're saying is, the first one, saying that human DNA has a direct effect on the physical world around us, on those photons, which is the basic constituent of everything in our world. Everything's made out of light, of photons. The second experiment is showing that it's not related by time and distance, and that human emotion talks right. to the DNA.
Right.
And this now, through the language of 21st century science, is shedding new light on what so many of the ancient texts and traditions have tried to say in the language of their time. They said, when you become these things in your body, this is what you can expect. This is the healing you can expect. This is the peace you can expect in your world. And it is through these kinds of experiments that the Isaiah scroll is taking on new meaning.
All right. When we get back then, if you then take this, what should be pristine DNA, and you make it not so pristine by cloning, then really it is a good question about whether what results, what you have birthed, or if you will, what you have created, will have a soul.